In the Catholic Church, the concept of social justice has been greatly abused, even turned on its head. And we're going to look at the problems in the Catholic Church for Catholics voting left, voting communist, socialist principles. We're going to look at the popes and what they've said in the past, and then also understand how this relates to the errors of Russia from Our Lady of Fatima, and how it is that in the Catholic Church, we have been infiltrated, not just morally, but also in our worldview. And today with me is co-host Timothy Gordon. Good morning, Timothy. How are you?
Morning. A little good. Sick, but good. Thanks.
I hope you're getting better. Everybody pray for Timothy. So we just, before we get into socialism, communism, the popes, and also looking at how in America, the Catholic bishops have been abusing funds and giving it to shady nonprofits. We're going to look at all that too today. And also how the U.S. bishops have been receiving money from the U.S. government. Lots of shady stuff there. But before we do, we just had a big week, midterm elections. And what's your thoughts on that, Tim? We didn't lose as much as we thought when it comes to the pro-life cause in America.
That's right. My thoughts are that the result wasn't as catastrophic as it could have been for, I think we can out and out say it, the pro-life cause is by language for the Republican Party, at least a portion within the Republican Party, didn't lose the Senate, wound up with 54-46 odds there, lost some in the House, but not as much as the last three or four presidents. But as this concerns the broader Catholic world, the issue that we have to get into some today is why are so many Catholics so consistently turning in for Democrats? This election, the numbers hot off the wire are 47 voted Republican, 47% voted Democrat. This is actually not as bad as it was in 2012 or 2014. I forget 2016, to be honest, but compare this to the Republican turnout by American Protestants, 63% to 38% Democrat. That's much more in keeping with what you would expect from any sort of serious believing Christian, right?
So Catholics are about 50-50 on the Democrat Republican vote.
Right.
And Protestants are a little bit 70-30-ish, just under on that, which is remarkable.
Right. It sounds a lot better. 50. But what I think we're going to be talking about today in more political philosophy / political theology language is what accounts for this. I mean, it's unacceptable given what the church calls innate evils on the Democrat platform. Like, not every Republican's a good guy. Not every Republican's even a conservative or even religious, but there are no innate evils on the platform. This is what makes it a slam dunk issue. And so how do you account for a 50-50 toss up among the Catholic electorate? It's really bad stuff.
Yeah. And I think the answer to that from a lot of people who'd object to what you just said would be that, well, abortion is not the only issue. And then they would name their big two, which is immigration, which we should talk about today as well, from Thomas Aquinas. I want to spend some time on that. Set the record straight. Immigration and being compassionate for the poor. Right. I'm going to say those two right there, those are big Catholic issues. And so, we can't just be a one issue voter. We have to use prudence and we have to think about larger issues in our community. We're going to see why that's wrong.
Right.
Immigration and acts of public charity. And I want you to talk about that today on Timothy from Aristotle and Aquinas and even from the Bible. Acts of public charity are not on par with, for example, the right to life.
Right.
Killing a baby in the womb is an intrinsic evil. The obligation to help someone when their house burns down or help the elderly, we do have a Christian obligation to do that, but it is not absolute and intrinsic. And that's a kind of a philosophical nugget on that, but we're going to go deeper in that today.
Right. And the interesting thing from 30,000 feet above is even when the earliest Christians take Chrysostom, who lots of Catholic leftists try to quote, when Chrysostom or the apostles of, you know, the Pentecostal era or the Didache or even the Patristics a couple hundred years later, when they talk about charity in the borderline, in the closest possible non-anachronistic sense to what today would be called social justice, it's never involved in wealth redistribution, which is really what I think we ought to get into.
Or the state
mandating such acts. What it always involves are concepts of exigency, like shipwreck. Chrysostom will talk about shipwreck, and so does the common law, right? In the case of shipwreck, it is a kind of duty to help the person you see, or you know, maybe a car accident. Not that the state should even mandate one person help another in a car accident, but the moral law does require this, whether or not the common law does. This is not a broad, sweeping program of wealth redistribution and station redistribution, where, you know, paupers all become princes and princes become paupers, right? That's an eschatological concept for us. That'll happen at the new creation. It's 100% fine that paupers are paupers and princes are princes. The wealthy are the wealthy and the poor are the poor. What the earliest Christians talk about, and Aquinas is very specific about, is just, you know, it's really the concept of subsidiarity. You help the people, the obvious cases that cross your path. And a lot of times this is already the proof that you don't need the government for this kind of charity, giving to us even a non-governmental organization like the American Red Cross, which is might as well be taxation because it's equally abstract. You're giving to a big, broad, faceless organization. You don't know who the recipient, who the beneficiary of your largesse is, right? Why not? I mean, before you do that, all of these first saints talk about it like, why don't you either give to someone in your life you know is needy? And it doesn't only have to be money. It can be time. That counts as charity. Mm-hmm. Or someone, maybe they are a stranger. They're three houses down from you in your neighborhood. Their house just burned down. Or you saw someone, because you're the person with the boots on the ground. We can get into it more, but the rationale is generally this. You're the person, you're the ref in the position to make the call, right? You have all those indicia, like this person's not just going to take this money and go use it on drugs. The Red Cross is not just going to take this and give it to a bunch of pro-abort causes.
Yeah, proximity brings accountability.
Precisely.
And that is the Catholic principle of subsidiarity, right? There's not this idea that I put $10 in this fund and then somehow it's going to go help someone in Nigeria. I mean, that's fine. We do that. I actually do that as well. It's not obligatory, but it's also not the best way to give. You know, someone in our comments, it was just a few days ago, was saying, hey, instead of just giving to these large slush funds, it could be the Red Cross or it could be a USCCB fund. We're going to get into that today. Why not donate to your local homeless shelter that's run by your Catholic church or whatever? I mean, it's right there. You know about it. You could even be involved in it, be on the board.
Right.
Donate your time there. Like, you actually have a personal connection with the charity. And, you know, like when we look at Aquinas and we look at the Catholic social teaching, the authentic one, there should, in the Book of Proverbs too, when you give alms, there should be a personal connection.
Right. Right. This went without saying for them, by the way. They didn't bother to dispute the oppositional point of view because the oppositional point of view didn't exist yet. No one, even under the sweeping Roman Empire, none of these thinkers ever fathomed a state so large as ours. I'd like to talk about this even from the perspective of 1776. None of these guys conceived of such a large state that would be in a place to take like a digital payment and redistribute it, you know, to be, because of the visions of a classless, moneyless society. This is beyond reckoning for them. Mm-hmm. So they assumed it. And occasionally you get a mention by one of the early saints, like, obviously you do it because these people are in your day, they're in your way, and you help them where you can. But except the reason that you get so few explicit repudiations of the idea of this broad humanist socialism, egalitarian socialism, which has really got at its root the vision of a classless society, you know, no classes, no hierarchy, is because it didn't even exist, even in the Roman Empire, even then in the Holy Roman Empire. It's unfathomable to them how wicked this concept of a classless society is. And it didn't really exist until strains of proto-Marxism and then Marxism.
Yeah. One of the interesting facts that a lot of Catholics don't yet know, and this is sort of a truth bomb, a wake up, a red pill moment, is that the United States government gives a lot of money to the USCCB. The USCCB is the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And I'm just going to throw out some numbers here that are verified. And in fact, these numbers were reported by the USCCB. So we're not making these up. Ever since 1975, the USCCB has received taxpayer money from the government. In 2013, the bishops received $73 million for the government. That came out to 32% of their budget. So one third of the money in the pocket of the USCCB comes from Uncle Sam. You didn't know that when you were paying your taxes, you were also helping one third of the budget of USCCB. 2014, they received $79 million. 2015, they received $80 million from the U.S. government. 2016, they received a big increase, $95 million from Uncle Sam in 1 year. That's 39% of their total budget. So their total budget is more and more dependent on the U.S. government. How are they getting this money, Timothy? Primarily through migrant and refugee services.
Wow.
Immigration.
Yeah.
So basically, the USCCB and diocese are saying, okay, we're going to relocate, and they get a price per head of how many people come into the United States legally or illegally. The Catholic Church helps find them a job, settle them, whatever, right? Get them integrated into society. For everyone that they do that for, the government writes them a check. So it's
can
a
you say
business.
Ulterior motive?
It's a, yeah, business, it's a business, right? So these people are coming into the country legally or illegally, and it's at the best interest for the USCCB to have more and more people coming into this nation. Just look at the numbers. From 2013 to 2016, that's 3 years, they went from 32% of their budget to 39% of their budget. They figured it out. Like, okay, we need more people. Just keep more people. And then when you get a president like Trump who comes in and says, no, we're going to shut that down, we're going to build a wall, they are up in arms.
Right.
You know, we didn't see our bishops, you know, angry and preaching and calling out the government when we had same-sex unions, marriage passed.
Right.
We didn't see it with abortion. We see some of them.
Right.
You know, we didn't see it with the conscience clause on Obamacare. No, it was basically crickets. But boy, you come after their money. You come after this immigration money. That's 39% of their total budget. That's just the USCCB. Individual dioceses are also getting shares and cuts out of this.
That's right.
They're mad. And so Catholics, if your bishop is out there or other bishops and you see them just fervently preaching like they never have before on immigration, which is not a dogmatic issue, it's all about those Benjamins.
Couple points there. Number one, the seamless garment, first pushed by Cardinal Bernardine, a big name that figures his way into a lot of our discussions. He's the one that first started pushing this idea of a seamless garment of human rights, meaning, yeah, human life is sacred, but this doesn't just co-involve abortion, beginning of life issues, and euthanasia, end of life issues. He is the liberal mastermind within the Catholic Church that said, sure, I guess we have to, by dint of implication, we have to be on the Catholic side there. There's not a lot of massaging we can do to these concepts, even though my inclination is to suspect that they even probably resent having to be on the right side of those issues. Look at Cardinal Danneels, for instance, who persuaded right. the King of Belgium to be pro-choice. But by
say that
large,
again, Timothy, because people need to hear that. Cardinal Danneels, the guy Cardinal on the balcony Danneels. With Francis.
Yeah, pro Saint Gallen mafia guy, very close friend of Francis, convinced single-handedly, as the story happens, the King of Belgium to make abortion legal. But yeah. but this is more the exception than the norm. Like, usually, what are our bishops on abortion and euthanasia? More often than not, they're kind of cautiously silent. If you force them to speak, they'll be like, well, yeah, technically the position on this of the Catholic Church on this most pressing genocide that's been happening, you know, for since before Roe versus Wade in many states, is we have to say we're pro-life. And that's the most you'll get them to say. But because of Cardinal Bernardine, we have this concept of the seamless garment, which the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith has rejected several different times in several different ways.
Yep.
No, migration, human trafficking, poverty, these are not bona fide life issues. But you see how when you talk about poverty and the hijack of charity, when you talk about migration, emigration, and for all the reasons you just described, it lines the pockets of corrupt institutions worldwide, including the USCCB. They get to get all their gimmies and their ideological goodies all at once, and they get their pockets lined. So that's why they're always repackaging, they're always reanimating this argument of the seamless garment of, yeah, let's include within the life issues, quality of life issues that right. are.
And I, as a Catholic, I want to say, I don't want to be too firm and say these are not life issues. They are life issues. Right. Having, you know, health care is a life issue. Having food is a life issue. Not being sold into sexual slavery is a life issue. All these are important. And as Catholics, we are morally obligated to fight against them. Absolutely. But as the church teaches, as John Paul II taught, as Ratzinger clarified on the seamless garment, those are all under, they're logically placed under the right to life. Can't be sold into sex slavery if you were aborted in the womb. You know, you can't be a hungry child if you were aborted in the womb. Right. So we have to. That's the first and the most important issue. That we have to tackle as, because if you don't have the right to life, all those other ones are arbitrary.
Well, OK, it's a dialogue show, so I think it's good. I actually disagree on this one. I think when you call, and that's good, that's probably people probably want to see more of that. It's very rare that you and I come to any kind of loggerheads. I object to the idea. It's a quality of life issue, but I mean, and of course it's a life issue in the broad sense that everything that happens in life is a life issue, right? And so I'm not disagreeing there, but when it comes to sneaking it into the seamless garment that's essentially a rubber stamp, I object because the life issues, broadly speaking, insinuate, you know, issues where life will be as a clear and present danger removed, right? Either at the beginning of life, the most innocent, you know, the voiceless fetuses, or the end of life, who are maybe not the most innocent, but people who need protection, the truly elderly, the truly infirm elderly, life will be removed. Now, if we don't redistribute wealth, say in America, take that issue, the poorest class, for instance, have actually, by the standards of the gospel, the New Testament, great lives, right? I mean, well, you get Democrat, you know, Saturday morning public service commercial announcements talking about, like, well, these people, you know, we actually have an overweight impoverished class, and there are Saturday morning yeah. cartoon commercials about, well, they're actually overweight because they're eating fast food too much because they can't afford more healthy issues. Okay, so this is inconceivable to the apostles of the Didache, that we would be right. counting as a life issue the fact that people are having Big Macs instead of quinoa or at their meals.
Yeah, kale salad. So
kale salad. Like, I don't. Yes, everything's a life issue because it happens under life, but it's a quality of life issue. Does that jive with?
Yeah, I agree. I'm not saying that. I'm not advocating the seamless garment by any means. No. But I think that some people hear us say that the other issues are not life issues. I'm just saying that those are all sub points under the right to life, both at the beginning and the end.
Certainly.
Right.
Yeah.
And we as Catholics are concerned about every bullet point beneath there. And then, of course, we can quibble and debate. If you are 200 pounds overweight, by the gospel standards, are you a poor person? If you have a home and you have maybe a car, but it's a little junky, right, and you're overweight and you have plenty of food, are you destitute, as, you know, like you'd see in the book of Proverbs, or, you know, the poor that Christ speaks of? You know, we need to define poverty and what poor means, you know.
Right. That's key. We should do that in a moment. I'd just like to point out that when I was at USD law school back in 2009, which is technically speaking a Catholic university, they had a pro-life week, and seamless garment was on point there. It was on full display. They shoved abortion, euthanasia, I think, they had like a different topic every day. It was like the Wednesday when barely anyone was on campus. This Wednesday, it was the middle of the week, and they barely promoted it.
Yeah.
They were promoting human trafficking, which actually it figures its way into the pedophilia issue that the first world seems to be confronting right now. I didn't understand as much back in 2009, but I don't, you know, I think they meant it more in the context of migration, which is almost all they talked about.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is the seamless garment. It's an argument by disproportionate emphasis.
Yeah.
So they can just emphasize the true life issues, abortion, euthanasia, almost out of view. Subpoint B, remember, there's a 2004 Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith document. It's just a short little letter put out by Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger at that point, where he says explicitly that war, right, and poverty are issues on which, or no, war and the death penalty are issues on which it is 100% fine for full communion with Rome Catholics to disagree on, right? You can be pro-war, or I'm anti. You can be pro-death penalty, or I'm anti. But it is not acceptable, and he's talking in the realm of voting,
yes.
So it's been relevant all week. It is not acceptable to vote for a pro-choice candidate or a pro-euthanasia candidate if there's an anti-candidate on the ballot, right. an anti-abortion candidate on the docket. You can't do it. So it's clear, and this is a magisterial teaching of the faith. He upheld it. It's really good. That's seamless garment. I think it's
there's a video, a short video that I did with Austin Roos on seamless garment. I'll put that in the top right corner. If you want to find out why the seamless garment is a joke, click that link and check it out.
Right. The second point I promised earlier that's really, really important is if you look at, this goes back to immigration, Thomas Aquinas on national sovereignty, right? He places national sovereignty, patriotism, as actual virtues.
Yes.
The violation of which would be sinful. He doesn't go into how
they're under the virtue of justice.
Of justice.
Can I jump in and explain that real quick? Because it's a really important point that we need to learn as Catholics. So Thomas Aquinas, there's four cardinal virtues. Justice is one of them. Justice is basically giving what's owed to another.
Right.
So, for example, you owe your wife fidelity, you owe your parents honor, you owe God worship just for creating you, right? So there's what you owe. It's obligation. to others, what's due to one another. And then he states that we also have an obligation of honor towards our patria, our homeland, our nation, right? And it's by law. Like, it's not like, yeah, I don't really like my country. No, you know, you may not like certain things in your country, but you owe right. honor and respect to your country, the place of your birth, the right. land of your birth, your patria. And so this is part of virtue. It's part of justice. So anyone who's trying to teach you about social justice who violates that has already turned justice on its head. One more pet peeve I have. This term social justice is so dumb. All justice is social.
Right.
There's
right,
no right. individuated justice. Justice always has multiple persons involved because it's giving to one what is due. So this whole idea right. of social justice was really just a way to slip in socialism. We're going to get into that in just a bit. But you don't need to say social justice. That's a pet peeve of mine. Just say justice like we did right. for 2,000 years.
Right. So the birthplace of the natural law is by and large accepted to be book five of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, which is where he talks about the virtue of justice, and he defines it. And Thomas basically takes everything chapter and verse from Aristotle and just adds to it and Christianizes it. But he says, what is justice? Only one. There's a general sense of justice and a particular sense of justice. Only the particular sense of justice counts as, in terms of virtue ethics. Right. And it's exactly what you said. It's each giving to the other his due. And this is how it enters the realm of individual habituation and
right.
the Aristotelian habit thing, which we should talk about sometime. General justice, though, is not a virtue because it's a general penumbra term that just involves the concept of law abidingness and following just laws. So you just say it's just that when a law is rightly made in a decent regime, it's widely followed. But yeah, so particular justice is the sense where Thomas says, and this is where I really think we should talk about this, maybe here. Why is it just, following Aristotle and Thomas, to give $3 to this employee and $6 to this employee if that's what you promised them, instead of why not split the difference and give them each $4.50?
Right.
So this is a big concept. In Aristotle, he talks about it as the difference between geometric proportion mm-hmm. and arithmetic proportion. Geometric proportion, interestingly, get this, it's Catholics need to hear it. Geometric proportion is what equates with justice. Arithmetic, and it just means if I owe you $6 and I owe you three rubles, my two employees, I give you $6 and I give you $3. Arithmetic proportion would violate justice by me going, okay, you earned $6, you earned $3, but you know what? I'm shelling out $9 anyway. I'm just going to split the difference, give you each $4.50. I gave you $1.50 too much. I gave you $1.50 too little.
So it's not just.
The egalitarian, the equal, this is where I really wanted to go. The equal is always in tension with the just.
Everybody pray for Tim. He's sick.
Very. Yeah. Can't get over this cough. But can people wrap their heads around that? The equal yes. is in tension with the just, yes. right? It's not when Aristotle talks about this in the previous book, book four of the Ethics, when he talks about the virtue of spending properly, magnificence, right? He says, look, for an aristocrat, It's actually a vice. It's non-virtuous to underspend. You need to spend at least in accord with your station.
Yeah.
Meaning, like you said earlier, Dr. Marshall, the president shouldn't show up in jeans.
And a wife beater.
And a wife beater. Because remember, hierarchy matters. This is what we've gotten so away from. Right. Along
and
with the concept
the president shouldn't show up dressed like King Louis IX. That's also sure. incorrect.
Sure. Right. Right.
And you shouldn't show up at your wedding in Bermuda shorts. There's a dignity to what you are about to perform that you should match. And that is justice.
Right. But it's a little different for someone of a lower station, and that's fine. And both Aristotle and right. Thomas affirm this. Like, not everyone's the same. We don't have to pretend everyone's the same. This classless society stuff is the socialist germ that's been injected into everything.
Right. That everyone must be the same. And you push on it and you push on it and you push on it. You know, well, what about men and women? The same. There is no difference between men and women. You push. Or even get into this. What about turtles and whales? The same. Push. Right. That is right. not Christian.
It's not
that Christian. That is not rational. It is not natural. It's insane. No. It's truly insane.
It's a humanist, it's a secular humanist concept that has been forced in, as is the equalization of all natural unequals under God in nature, under really proto-Marxist ideas, kind of like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and then eventually Marxism wrote it large. And now people are saying, oh, what about a Christian feminism? What about a Christian socialism? Mm-mm. You hear about the former more than the latter. The latter is really insidious, right. and it's just worked its way into charged terms like your social justice. Like you said, justice is always social. It's one of the few virtues Aristotle and Thomas discuss that can't really be privatized, right? It always, Aristotle has this saying, he says, office will show a man. It means an aristocrat who eventually takes office will show his best self because he's inherently brought into relationship with the people.
If he's a true aristocrat,
if he's one of the natural a noble. Yeah. So their justice is inherently social. It's like saying ATM machine or something, an automatic teller machine.
Yeah.
You don't have to say it.
You don't have to say social justice. Just say the virtue of justice says. That's it.
Thank you.
Because justice always includes the society, social, people.
Yeah, right? Totally true. I'm always telling my students that.
Yeah, don't say social justice. So to draw out this problem of socialism as it relates to justice, I want to share just some quotes from Pope Leo XIII. This is from Rerum Novarum. I did an article on this a while back. We'll put the link. It's 5 quotes from Leo XIII. I don't want to go through all of them, but there are some money quotes here, and I want to share them. The first one from Rerum Novarum goes like this, quote, "To remedy these wrongs, the socialists, working on the poor man's envy of the rich," and I'll just pause there. First off, notice two things. Leo XIII is saying he's condemning the socialists, and the church always uses socialists to condemn these errors. And he says, based on the poor man's envy. So you're already breaking the Ten Commandments. The socialist is working on envy. I'll continue the quote. "Are striving to do away with private property and condemn that individual possession should become the common property of all to be administered by the state or by municipal bodies. They hold that thus by transferring property from private individuals to the community, the present mischievous state of things will be set to rights. Inasmuch as each citizen will then get a fair share of whatever there is to enjoy. But their contentions are so clearly powerless to end the controversy that they carried into effect the working man himself would be among the first to suffer. They are, moreover, emphatically unjust." That's the Pope speaking. "They are more emphatically unjust, for they would rob the lawful possessor, distort the functions of state." We got to talk about this, Timothy.
Absolutely.
"Distort the functions of the state and create utter confusion in the community." So Leo XIII, I'm going to hand the mic to you in just a second, Tim. He says, look, they work on envy and they cause the working man to suffer, which we know if you just look at communist Russia or Cuba. And they rob the possessor, distort the function of the state, create confusion. I mean, this is like a slam dunk. You cannot be a Catholic socialist, period.
No.
Drop the mic. Don't come to me and talk to me like that.
So what he means by distortion of the function of the state's central function is to not stand in the way of private virtue, right?
And you could say in Aristotle, actually, politics is ethics in a society, in a nation. That's what politics traditionally defined is.
Aristotle, so it's to allow ethics. he thought that the ethics was the introductory book to the politics, and he thought that the politics would be all anyone would be interested in, is his teachings on the politics. And we very few people read anything outside of book two of the politics. But the ethics is the setup for politics, and there is no distinction. There is a very, in an academic way, this is actually what I was beginning a dissertation on. There is some W.D. Ross, a famous Aristotle scholar, says you can watch Aristotle grow between books one and two of the ethics, where he seems to have all the ancient assumptions of the city state about basically morality and legality should completely overlap. And then you get to book five, the locus in quo of natural law, the birthplace of it in many ways, where he says that the good man and the good citizen must at times depart. And W.D. Ross even says, this is like a legal positivism, the idea that legality and morality don't always overlap perfectly. It's a very complex question. And Ross says you can even see Aristotle kind of working it out as he writes. It's not clear how much, even within an acceptable Catholic point of view, one should endorse legality and morality to overlap, but we can say that it should be some. So all of my libertarian impulses, and I have many, are challenged by this, yeah. Right? Like this, a well-made law, says Aristotle, and Thomas follows it directly in his commentary. A well-made law should, generally speaking, promote virtue. But of course, there's this more libertarian gloss that Thomas will add to this, saying what's not prescribed is permitted, like we were even talking about on Halloween. But so generally speaking, what Pope Leo XIII is pointing at here is a fundamental perversion and subversion of the functions of the state. I talk about this in my book, Catholic Republic, almost exclusively in chapter one. The subversion at work is to take the natural hierarchy that's constitutive of society. That means, what is society? It's a series of hierarchies. The family is a hierarchy, right? The father runs the family. There are three acceptable regimes of government, says Aristotle and Thomas. There's monarchies, you could do those. There's polity, you could do those, or aristocracy. There's republic, you could do those. Each one has a perversion when things start going wrong. All of them are hierarchical, just like the family is presumed to be hierarchical. So egalitarianism, get this, folks, egalitarianism subverts the fundamental role of the family and the state when you start saying that whales and whatever you said, frogs are equal, men and women are equal. No, we're equal in dignity, completely unequal in terms of what we're good at and who should lead the men. The king. Is not
Timothy, before you move on, you basically just quoted Leo XIII, and so I want people to see that.
Hit it.
Okay,
hit it.
And then you could keep going back into it. So this is Leo XIII.
Get it.
All right. Leo XIII says, quote, "And for this very reason, that the child belongs to the father, it is, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, before it attains the use of free will under the power and the change of its parents. The socialist, therefore, in setting aside the parent and setting up a state supervision, act against natural justice and destroy the structure of the home," end quote. So it's exactly what you just said, Timothy. And notice he says, socialist, act against natural justice. So it's just two things you had said right there. It's against justice and it destroys the structure of the home. Why? Because the structure of the home is not egalitarian. It's hierarchical. That means all men out there, you got to be a good dude. You got to lead.
Right.
You got to be on point.
Yeah, literally, not to just shamelessly plug my book, Catholic Republic, but
do it.
Each of these quotes that you have so far get a major section in chapter one of my book. The child belongs to the father.
Yeah, here it is.
Awesome.
Here's the book.
Thanks.
And it's in the show notes too. You can go down there and click it. Get it on Amazon.
Awesome. Yeah, so the child belongs to the father, not the state. There are so many implications of this one short little line. Thomas repeats it. Aristotle repeats it. This one, this is a rare instance. I think it actually comes from Plato. Aristotle challenges more in Plato than most non-scholars realize. But this actually comes first from Plato to Aristotle, to Thomas, and neither of them find anything to challenge in it. And then finally to Pope Leo. This is a radical, radical statement against socialism, just like you're saying. Meaning several things at once. But obviously it has most obvious implications for things like social services. But it's a direct connection between the family and the state, which is very Catholic. The family is the single cell of the state, coming directly out of our catechism. I forget what CCC paragraph number that is, but the single cell is the buzzword. And it's utterly Aristotelian. Aristotle says, as the eminent Robert Riley is wont to quote, that chastity is the number one family virtue, and therefore it is the number one civic virtue. And what he's talking about is this, that the child belongs to the parent, namely the father. And the state will absolutely fall apart if the hierarchical structure of family begins to fall apart. And this is what socialism is. So when we talk about charity, I know you're going to go to those other Leo quotes, and they'll probably point us in the same direction. When we talk about charity, it's a radically different thing than even most of your conservatives in the audience are probably thinking about it as. It has nothing to do with a fundamental challenge to social structures. It has nothing to do with wealth redistribution. I don't know if you've ever, I've never seen you talk on distributism, you know, this quasi-Catholic point of view that's gotten very popular. I think we should do a show on it at some point. Really, really important. No, all wealth redistribution is fundamentally anathema to Catholicism. All wealth redistribution, that's not what the purposes of taxation are.
Yes.
Thomas lists like prosecuting wars, right? Building social structures and paying the civil servants. Yep. Those are only three social functions you'll ever find for taxation. If someone needs a hand, right? Someone's house burns down, that is the role of neighbors. Mm-hmm. And of course, Aristotle's pre-Christian by 350 years. For Christians, that's the role of neighbors to help out. Family, friends. This is not the role of the government at all.
Right. Yeah. And in the parable of the Good Samaritan, there's no government worker showing up in that story at all.
Yeah. Why not? Yeah.
And I'm going to quote Leo the 13th again to just confirm what you just stated for everyone's like, Timothy, I don't know about his ideas. No, Timothy's basically quoting Leo the 13th. Listen to this quote by Leo the 13th. Again, Rerum Novarum, goes like this. Quote, the first and most fundamental principle, therefore, if one would undertake to alleviate the conditions of the masses, must be the inviolability of private property.
Yep.
Leo the 13th says, hey, if you want to alleviate the conditions of the masses, don't do socialism. You must confirm that private property is the basis of all this. If people can come and take your goods, if that's ever on the table, you're screwed.
Right. Right. And so, yeah, that flies in the face of even people we like, you know, like I mentioned, G.K. Chesterton, Hilaire Belloc, you know, how do you redistribute? Well, they'd say they'd claim they like private property, but how do you ever wind up with 3 acres? How does everyone universally wind up with 3 acres and a mule? Outside of heaven, that might be what we all get. I'd love to have 3 acres and a mule and just have my family. And when I choose to see my friends, I see them. I love the Benedict option, but I don't own 3 acres and a mule as of right now. Right. I'm embarrassed to say I live in the suburbs.
And it's not contrary to justice that you don't own that.
No, it's not that. So that's where you get into these good thinkers in other realms of thought. G.K. Chesterton, Hilaire Belloc, the two godfathers of distributism, a Catholic view which claims to be a halfway point between socialism.
I'm just going
to
say, are you a fan, Tim? I'm not a fan.
No, not at all.
I'm not either. I think it's bogus.
I think it's
socialism under a sheet. That's my take.
No, it is.
Yeah.
But see, what we're talking about is right on point. That quote, the last two quotes you just pulled from Leo the 13th, prove that all political economies are either must either incline toward capitalism. I call it free enterprise. Again, this is just chapter one of my book. I have all this stuff collected. Free enterprise or some social planning. I don't call the other side socialism. Just call it a centrally planned economy. Borrow Hayek's term. Because literally, like the distributists, like Belloc and Chesterton, say, oh, there's a middle point because we like private property, but unlike the socialists, all manner of socialists reject the idea of private property. But we want to, and the two thinkers split on this, we want to force the redistribution of private property. Here's the trick that they just pulled. When you say we like private property, what you're really vouchsafing is private property rights, the inviolability of it, which Leo XIII just laid down magisterially.
Based in nature.
Based in nature. When someone owns something, it's natural and virtuous in the Aristotelian sense that they've gained ownership of that thing. Now, everyone would always ask G.K. Chesterton, okay, that sounds great, dude, but how does it work? How do we all wind up with 3 acres and a mule? He could never answer.
Yeah.
Belloc.
And that's the other thing.
Wait, but I have to get this in. Hilaire Belloc admitted openly, yes, at one point, there's one place in his writings where he says, yeah, it would require the government stepping in. That's just socialism. I don't care whether you say you like private property. Belloc said, no, this would be forcible redistribution. Boom. Sorry, it's over. There is no distributism short of heaven.
Yep. And I apologize for jumping in because that's exactly what I wanted to say is you're going against Leo XIII.
Yeah.
And then another problem with Belloc and Chesterton on this point, and I love their writings and I think they're great, but I think they're just wrong on this point, is instead of using a term Christian socialism, they're using this distributivism. Well, it's not socialism. We're just distributing wealth. It's the same thing. And Pius XI condemned this. I'm going to read the quote. This is from Quadragesimo Anno, 1931. Pius XI says, quote, religious socialism, Christian socialism are contradictory terms. No one can be at the same time a good Catholic and a true socialist, end quote. If anyone comes to you and says they're a Christian or a Catholic socialist, show them that quote and say, contradiction, you can't be that. Boom. That's like saying I'm a pro-choice Catholic. No, you're not. You can't.
Yeah. You're one or the other, or I'm a Catholic feminist. Yeah, there's mutual exclusion. And just real quick, Quadragesimo Anno, the name of that encyclical, that means 40th year after Rerum Novarum.
Right.
In other words, Pius XI thought that Rerum Novarum was, which it is, the like proof text for all 20th century and post 20th century social teaching, which it is proven to be.
Yeah.
That he literally named his encyclical
40 years.
The 40th years after this. So it's like everything he said, and I'm going to add some more gloss in the midst of fascism sprouting up in Italy, this weird, you know, kind of workers' movement sprouting up in Germany. It's all socialism, right? National socialism, international socialism. He's writing after the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. It's all socialism, just variant forms of socialism or central planning. And again, yeah, it's beautiful. That's an amazing quote.
I think Pius XI, they've been, you know, Catholics have been saying, oh, well, we're not socialists like Leo XIII condemned. We're the new kind of socialists. We're the Christian socialists.
Right.
And Pius XI said, can't do that.
No, get out of here. Get
also, another thing that you hear amongst Catholics, and we've heard it from Pope Francis, is that Rerum Novarum and Pius XI are condemning capitalism. That you can't be communist or socialist, you can't be capitalist. That's not the Catholic way. Listen to Pius XI. Quote, he says, capitalism itself is not to be condemned.
Boom.
And surely it is not vicious of its very nature, but it has been vitiated. Okay, so he's saying capitalism is not in se evil.
No.
It can be corrupted.
Of course.
Pius XI is saying socialism is always per se evil. Capitalism, not. Capitalism can be virtuous and good. It can also be evil. It can be a vice based.
Okay.
And that's the Catholic teaching.
The Catholic teaching is that anyone who's been challenged on this issue or feels like, isn't it proper for Bullock and Chesterton to try to find maybe a geometric mean, maybe it's closer to capitalism than socialism, but shouldn't we try to find this third way, which distributism does? Mm-hmm. No, here, imagine this. Your kids go out onto the sidewalk and set up a lemonade stand. This is capitalism. Assuming they're probably ganking from you, by the way, all the raw materials, right. But set that aside for a second. What do kids do? Every kid that's ever set up a lemonade stand's like, first thought, dude, let's just charge $50 for a glass of lemonade. We'll be out here for a couple minutes, then we'll be like millionaires. What they realize, this is just the invisible hand operating, right? Mm-hmm. All of the ineffable, almost unfathomable factors that go into the prices of all of those capitals, means of production, all of the constituent parts of a glass of lemonade have been preset. And so it's really, and Aristotle talks about this also in book 6 of the Ethics, without even meaning to defend capitalism. Nature is already set. It's a range. You might be able to get away with 75 cents for a glass with one customer, whereas another customer will only pay 50. That's a natural range. But because of the invisible hand, right, because of the natural value of commodities, a pair of shoes isn't worth as much as a house, which is why we need money. How else does the cobbler pay the home builder, Aristotle says. Because of these natural prices, literally, they'll go, okay, it can't be 50. So the kids will start dropping the glass of a price of lemonade. They figure out it's nature working this out. That is capitalism. Eventually, then they might drop it too far and more cars start stopping. If you drop it to 10 cents, you're like, oh, cars are stopping every 5 seconds. We could probably bump it back up. So you're literally equivocating and finding what the range, it's not an exact price, that nature has selected for this glass of lemonade. That's all capitalism is. It's freedom of property and it's freedom to contract. Contract meaning a goods and a bill of sale contract. No one's forcing that person to buy a $50 glass of lemonade. No one's forcing the producer to sell it for only 5 cents, which wouldn't be worth their time.
Right.
It's a combination of these two natural rights. We got life, liberty, and property. These are the Amendments 5 and 14 natural rights. And it's just a combination of those two. That's all capitalism is in its non-corrupted form. So we do not need a third way between capitalism and socialism. All we need is a relatively unspoilt version of capitalism. Free enterprise is what I like to go with because capitalism's been so maligned by wicked people in the last 100 years.
Yes, we cannot, it says, we cannot condemn capitalism. If you're a Catholic out there, Pius XI says, quote, capitalism itself cannot be condemned. Now, someone might say, well, yeah, but what about when we get more like in the more modern church? John the 23rd would never say that. Well, here's a quote from John the 23rd, quote, Pope Pius XI further emphasized the fundamental opposition between communism and Christianity and made it clear that no Catholic could subscribe even to moderate socialism, end quote. That's John the 23rd.
I didn't know that.
That's on Mater et Magistra, John the 23rd, 1961, just before the Second Vatican Council.
It's surprising.
Here's another money quote while we're on it. The reason is, this is John the 23rd, the reason is that socialism is founded on a doctrine of human society, which is bounded by time and takes no account of any objective other than that of material well-being, end quote. So it's a closed-in system.
Right.
Communism. There's no supernatural. There's no soul. There's no teleology. It's just all there is matter. So let's distribute the matter equally, period. It's an atheistic worldview.
Again, it's a violation of justice because when an employer owes more to more skilled laborers, right? In an oil and gas company, you're going to pay more to your reservoir engineers than you will to your roughnecks in the field. Why is that? Because of nature. Once we establish my little lemonade example, instantiated by your last two quotes, the natural rightness, the recto ratio that confirms what we already know in our common sense, that not all commodities are the same. you know, a house is worth more than a pair of shoes, then that also conduces to the natural skill within laborers. Aristotle and Thomas Jefferson actually rips this quote directly from Aristotle, called the natural aristoi. Those in an economy who are more skilled workers are a natural aristoi because we need their services are worth more. And that's it's a little different in an honor-based society, a timocracy, which is more what Aristotle's talking about. In a merit-based society, that's more like economic merit, which is what we have. Anyone can be anything. It doesn't matter if your father was poor. If you're really great at building houses, you can be rich. If you're really great as a reservoir engineer, you can be rich. Because of that natural disparity of commodities, some things are worth more than others. In an economy like ours, which is a little different from Aristotle's, people will be paid different wages, differing wages, and that's fine, right? So to say, well, to give, you know, let's just take, I owe this employee A 20 and this employee B 10. Let me, instead of giving them what's geometrically due, 20 and 10, it's still $30 out my back pocket. Let me just do 15 and 15. It's fundamentally wrong. It's wicked. It's wicked. Vicious. And people will respond to this, our Lord and the day laborers, right? I think the vineyard, they'll say, well, what about that gospel? Is that Mark, the Gospel of Mark, where, you know, our Lord says, well, this guy showed up the last hour of the day and you paid him the same wages. Notice what is not happening there. The employer in our Lord's parable is not rob. He's not saying, I owe this guy 30 and this guy 10, so I'm just going to split the difference and go 20. He's still paying 30. Yeah. He's still, the employer is still paying 30
he goes
to the man who owes 30. The underling, the hireling who came on the last hour, he just goes up. Who is being robbed by that? Who is being actually out? Well, just the employer. The employer is not robbed. He's not robbing, you know, this old expression by Reagan, rob Peter to pay Paul. You can always count on the vote of Paul, right? He's not robbing the good, full day laborer. He's robbing himself, if anyone.
Yeah.
So that's just the goodness of God. But that doesn't equate to the geometric versus arithmetic justice that is at root in the socialist scheme to really destroy all classes, to destroy all distinctions in society or the family.
Yeah. So what is a Catholic understanding of society? And I want to circle around because we began with Catholics supporting Democrat, pro-abortion, pro-socialist candidates. As you said, the numbers of this recent election are 50-50. Half of our Catholics in America voted Republican. Half of them voted Democrat. And there's going to be all kinds of people saying, hey, as Catholics, we're not any political. I get that, right? I understand that as citizens of the kingdom of God, we transcend all politics. But in the trenches, when I cast a vote, there's an R or a D next to the guy's name.
Right.
It just is what it is, right? That's not the R is not my fundamental ontological identity as a person. A baptized Christian is my ontological fundamental identity, but I have to bring that into my political identity and I have to make a vote. And there was not one single on my ticket pro-life Democratic candidate on the ticket.
Well, it's on the platform too. So this is where let me respond to that. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying, but let me add some gloss. The Democrat Party is not your grandpa's party. Catholics. So there's no such thing as a blue dog Democrat anymore. There's nothing even moderately resembling a blue dog Democrat, right? The Democrat Party is governed by one issue, abortion, right? Because abortion is so central to the idea of feminism, which is really at the heart of it. And migration is a close second, right? Because they figured out it's voting demographics. They need certain voting demographics, and you know it gets very Karl Rove-y from there. I don't want to go into the sort of boorish stats and figures of voting demographics. This is very boring stuff. But But this is, they've done all the analytics, they've crunched all the data, and it boils down to that. So abortion is central. It's on the platform. It's not, you're not going to run into more than a rogue one or two or three Democrats in the entire national scene that for political exigencies in their maybe West Virginia type area, you know, very conservative, that barely even puts forward a real Democrat. They have to violate the platform.
Yeah, the platform honestly, I wouldn't even give you three, Tim.
I don't think there are.
In the whole country.
I don't think there are. I don't think there are.
In this year, no way. Maybe in the 80s, 90s.
Right.
But that day, that ship is gone, man. There's not one pro-life Democrat running on any major race.
Why would there be? I mean, that's the other thing.
They don't want it. That's undermining their number one issue.
Right.
An exit poll showed in this recent election a couple days ago, 58% of American women voted for Democrats.
Right. That's what I was insinuating.
And the Democrats count on that. And it's an abortion issue. It's an abortion issue. Or they just thought Beto O'Rourke was cute, you know, or something even worse than that. But primarily, it is an abortion issue that's pushing this agenda.
But he made a real run.
I know, it was scary.
Yeah, it was scary. But an abortion obviously is, we already talked about the seamless garment. It's a non-negotiable, which is why I think it's a little silly when Catholics are talking, dioceses are saying, well, we don't want to tell you how to vote, but it's like, well, you already have, right?
Yeah.
The Democrat Party is unequivocally, it's made this its sacred cow, the abortion position. And there are reasons why. It's also made socialism writ large its sacred cow. We talk about the infiltration of socialism into American Catholicism and European Catholicism. Before it was far easier for socialism to pervade the Democrat Party. But then it was to invade the church, right? Come in. And so it was a far easier equation to make. And again, everyone out there, Catholic school, public school, has been brainwashed about, you know, so-called McCarthyism. Remember, Joseph McCarthy, when he was saying that the socialists are trying to infiltrate American politics in the Democrat Party, he was completely vindicated when the Venona files, if you don't look, if you want a source text, go look at the Venona files, the Venona papers, completely vindicated Joseph McCarthy. And if you don't believe that, just, you know, take the word from your own lying eyes, right? It's, you know, that Democrat politics are no longer American in the pre, you know, Bolshevik sense.
Yeah.
Everything is about wealth redistribution and the remaking of family and social structures. That's why it's all about hope and change.
Mm-hmm.
A humanist, immanentist recreation, you know, which is ripped from like the Book of Revelation, just put into history in real time because they don't believe in the Book of Revelation. Right. So it is atheistic socialism writ large in the Democrat Party, and it's very, very difficult to deny. So we don't have to talk about even abortion as the only issue. It's the most of a slam dunk. But all, you know, the rejection of capitalism, as you ripped from the encyclicals before, is even a valid reason to reject the Democrat partisan platform.
So why don't we finish on this point, and that is, why is it that U.S. bishops, priests, cardinals, laity are so aligned with the Democratic Party? And I'm going to give an example. When I was living in D.C., when Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House, she was allowed to have a victory mass in a Catholic church celebrating her as Speaker of the House, a pro-abortion political leader. Like, her record is perfect when it comes to promoting abortion.
It is.
And people asked around, and guess what? Cardinal Donald Wuerl gave the green light for it, for her to have a victory mass in Washington, D.C. And people were ticked. And I remember Worrell came to the Catholic Information Center to give a talk. And in the Q&A, this sweet little lady stood up and she said, Your Eminence, I don't want to be disrespectful, but why is it that you allowed Nancy Pelosi to have a victory mass in our diocese? And he got red and he got mad and he shouted her down. He says, and he said, I remember it. And everyone was just sort of, you know, looking at the floor. He says, I, as the Archbishop, am not responsible for the pro-life cause. You lay people are. Which is ridiculous, right? He's the one with the mitre and the crook, you know, not us. I can't go excommunicate or stop the mass for Nancy Pelosi. Right. And that talk was recorded, and I was the guy recording it.
Oh, really?
And he came up to me afterwards, Donald Worrell, and said, you delete that right now. Delete all of it. Because he didn't want it recorded. And I did delete it. Yeah, I did delete it. I wish I hadn't deleted it.
You should have been like,
because it was on record of him skirting his responsibility. So here's Worrell providing
your face.
Yes, to me directly. You know, within feet of me. Donald Worrell. So I've known Donald Worrell is a rotten cat going way back.
Wow.
But that is an example of Worrell providing a platform for Nancy Pelosi in the Catholic Church, a victory mass. And so why is it that we are seeing cardinals, bishops, priests, even popes providing a platform for socialism, for negative things? I already went over the numbers of the USCCB receiving money from the government, but the USCCB has also been caught giving funds, grants to nonprofits that are contrary to the Catholic Church. For example, the USCCB gave money to the Coalition on Homelessness. It received $240,000. And on their website, they support Planned Parenthood, birth control, homosexuality, transgenderism, legalized prostitution, and legalized drug abuse. So here's a nonprofit that got $250,000 over several years from the USCCB.
Wow.
Are they taking care of the homeless? Yes, that's great. Their platform is contrary to Catholic justice teaching. They also gave money to the Community of Alliance of Tenants, CAT, for 5 years. That, on their website, they promote homosexuality as well. So the USCCB is giving money to pro-abortion, pro-homosexuality nonprofits, and the bishops. As you said before, we're not telling you who to vote for. But I've heard, you know, letters are read in parishes about the importance of immigration, especially down here in Texas around election time. That's subtle.
Yeah.
But it says something.
So I wish it were a little more subtle.
Yeah.
And in California, it's, you know, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas. These are honestly, I mean, I'm going to say something that sounds kind of silly, but when I hear people from New Hampshire or New England, you know, any area of New England or Maine talking about immigration in the southern border, it's like, dude, come on. You don't even get you don't get a point of view. Like, I'm from, you know, it depends where you mark the geography, but southern or central California, this is the San Joaquin Valley. This is ground zero, and southern Texas counts as well. But it's like, come on, these people don't even know what's going on. I mean, how Thomas talks about this, maybe a closing word on immigration. The part of defending the sovereignty of a nation is defending its culture. So there's no racism or xenophobia at work in wanting to preserve your own culture, from particularly when a first world nation is on the borderline of a third world nation. It's like, third world nations are marked by a drastically more immoral jettisoning of the strictures of contract law. Laws aren't followed as well. If you go to even a second world nation like Italy, you set an appointment, I'll meet you at 1 sharp. It means 1:15 if ever, 1:30 if ever. Right. If you go to Germany, you know, close by, which has always, you know, been very rigorous in terms of its contract law, you say 1, it means 12:55. So this ends up having moral implications. And we as members of a first world nation that are closer to strict contract followers You know, you can't just pay off a cop that stands right. for something north of the border. Yeah.
You can't go get a sketchy surgery south of the border. You can south of the border. You can't north of the border.
Right.
Or sketchy right. drugs so, or whatever.
Right. So this all cross. Of course not. This cross feeds what Thomas Aquinas says about the sovereignty of culture. We have to defend it. And it's a good reason why, you know, one would want a wall. It's hilarious when Pope Francis derides Trump and the wall, you know, build the wall effort, and the international coalition against the United States making measures to protect its own southern border. The Pope has weighed in on this a few times in the main, saying, oh, building walls is bad. Well, last time I was out there in 2008, there's a 22-foot wall around Vatican City. Why did more people not say this?
And security checkpoints,
right.
metal detectors to go in, cops,
right.
police, guys holding machine M16s. Guns.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's nothing wrong with that. If you're going to have a country that's sovereign, you need borders. If you're going to have borders, you need to defend them.
Yeah.
These are first principles.
Yeah.
So I'm sick of, the international coalition against the wall.
A year and a half ago, I was out for a run with my son in Rome, and we decided we would make part of our run to run through St. Peter's Square. It's like 5:30 a.m. We're jet lagged, you know? And so we thought it'd be cool. Like the square will be empty. We'll just jog through it. The sun will be coming up and all that. Soon as we took one foot into St. Peter's Square, police came over. You cannot be in here. Get out. Get out.
Really?
Yeah. Jogging. Yeah. I'm in shorts and a t-shirt.
Wow.
Like, you know, like about to get thrown into the vehicle. Like they're serious. And I was like, you know, isn't that interesting that I can't even jog across your piazza
in a public square
in the morning,
Yeah.
I'm obviously not armed or anything. And yet we're hearing all this rhetoric about, you know, well, you have to let in all these immigrants into America.
Right. Which violates fundamental Catholic social teaching.
I mean, they're enforcing
borders.
An invisible border, really, at St. Peter's Piazza. You know,
that's shocking.
They're enforcing it, you know?
Yeah.
And you know what? It's fine. We just jogged a little bit out of the way. No big deal, you know?
Right. Without the hypocrisy, that's fine.
Right. It's just the hypocrisy of it that they are obviously protecting St. Peter's Square just from vandalism, damage, someone planting a bomb, you know, whatever. There's good reasons for it, so I don't fault them for it. I just fault them for the hypocrisy.
Sure. Same thing. I don't fault the Chinese for having the Great Wall of China. I understand.
Yeah, I get it.
Right.
Mongols are hard to deal with.
Right.
Dialogue doesn't always work.
I don't know that firsthand or anything. Like every time I've had an issue with a Mongol. No, I can imagine. And no problem with it. It's just don't condemn the concept of walls, locks.
Yeah,
guns.
You know, hate the game, not the player. Protected.
That's right. So I think it's really important that Catholics come to terms with this idea. If you read the Treatise on Law and Thomas Aquinas, if you read the Nicomachean Ethics, which is nothing but a preface for Aristotle's Politics, there are some extreme right-wing ideas in here. It's almost nothing but extreme right-wing ideas when one comes to the sections that consider what justice is and what natural justice is. It's an extreme defense, even an anachronistic defense before, you know, capitalistic free enterprise economy was a term of such concepts from political economy. It's a defense anachronistically before it even existed. A border wars, national sovereignty. It's a strong defense of having national sovereignty. It's a defense of the family before there was even this socialist attack on the family in the 20th century, right? The hierarchical, non-egalitarian structures that make all of these cells in society work.
Yeah. So what's the solution? You know, the people watching, and I think a lot of us in the Catholic Church, we kind of get it dumbed down. And I honestly think that we as Catholics, we should be opening up, you know, the Summa Theologiae. Second part of the second part where it talks about justice. Read that at night.
Right.
Read Aristotle's Politics. Read the Nicomachean Ethics. Have these conversations. If we're going to win the battle and go back to what Leo XIII was teaching, Pius XI, even John the 23rd, on what is a Catholic approach to government and to politics and to voting, we need to understand these concepts and we need to be able to confidently defend them. Wouldn't you agree? Yes, sir.
Absolutely. And the thing about reading Aristotle and Thomas, you know, says a couple of Aristotomists, but I teach them both to 12th graders, right, at the Catholic school. So they're not abstract. It's the easiest philosophy you'll ever read. Now, it's still philosophy, so it's a little bit dense, but it's so clear in its discursive format, both Aristotle and Thomas. It's not like trying to read, you know, Hegel or Kant or Schelling, which you have this historical convenience that the German philosophy of the 18th and 19th century that's famously difficult is also also demonstrably wrong. So you don't have to waste your time with that sort of German or French philosophy that's notably difficult language. Aristotle and Thomas is simple. Yeah, go read the Nicomachean Ethics, the section you adverted to in the Summa. It's, you know, some, you can buy it as a subsection. It's called the Treatise on Law when you buy it there. Second part of the second part. And then read these encyclicals. No,
Treatise on Law is in first part of the second part.
Oh, first part of the second part. Sorry. Yeah.
But the virtues are in the second part of the second part. And I just, if you want to read specifically the virtue of justice regarding your patriotism and your parents, that's Summa Theologiae, second part of the second part, question 101. Nice. That's a good one. It'll take you less than 5 minutes to read. If you want to read the law, Treatise on Law, that's first part of the second part in the 90s.
Questions 91, 92.
Yeah, 94 is kind of like the bullseye. That's what I did my dissertation on for the PhD, was in that section of the Summa. So that'll take you longer to read, but that's just thick, juicy, ribeye political theology right there.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So I we got to get deep, Catholics, man. We can't sit around and be dumbed down. We got to get armed. I think we can close up here. Like we always say, pray the rosary every day. If you're a man, be a leader, be inspirational to your wife and to your kids. Take it to the next level.
Be virtuous. It's at the heart of everything.
Be virtuous, be chaste. And I think we need to challenge our Catholics. We need to be intellectual.
Be intellectual, be virtuous. These are the two foremost political positions. They correspond with the two parts of the soul, the will and the intellect. The will was designed to be virtuous. The intellect was designed to make us able to, you know, habituate the will to virtue.
Yeah. So I mean, our enemies are reading, they're speaking, they're writing, they're producing. They're producing a lot more YouTube videos than Timothy and I are. I guarantee you that.
They do.
And they're on Netflix and they're everywhere. So we got to get into it. This is not a time to abandon the fight. This is a time to go into extra training, extra sessions.
Well, yeah. So we keep getting this question in all of the com boxes from all of the videos. What do we do? Hmm. This is a little bit like someone asking this question in 1775, I think. What do we do? It's like, well, that. No, say 1770 American colonies.
Okay.
What do you do? You know, Tea Act, Townsend Act, Stamp Act, Sugar Act are passing. You're in 1770, you're getting a more organic response, right? People are getting like pissed. So rather than having the inorganic, well, what next? Just react. So if you're a priest, you know, in church, and this is a political principle, this is more than it is a theological principle, which is why I raise it here. If your priest says something that's wrong, or he tells your wife not to veil, or he tells you not to take it on the Eucharist on the mouth, then react. Like react like a human. Just, you can get mad, you know. At times, if the offense is egregious, you can even yell. So you have to react in real time, and see, it'll be much more clear what to do. Read the right political philosophy, which Dr. Marshall just mentioned 2 minutes ago. They're very simple books. And all of what I'm saying here would be affirmed by that. You know, rebellion is natural when you have unjust overlords, you know, little mini skirmishes where you just say, you're not going to tax, you're not going to put a tariff on this leverage. I'm going to get mad. Well, how do I get mad? It's almost like someone asking how to be a point guard in basketball, it's like, well, you got to just start. You got to start.
Go in there and get the ball. Get the ball. Yeah.
Get the ball. Start dribbling. Yeah. Aristotle says, if you want to be a builder, how do you become a builder? You start building. You'll be bad at first.
Right.
You'll be bad at rebelling. We've become a too docile people as Americans in particular.
Right.
Right. You just have to react. If a priest says something that's heresy, this should make you mad. And it's proper to say, I don't know exactly what to say, but yeah, I mean, do like, it every week.
Like we talked about in the last video, like in First Maccabees, like I love the Maccabees because it wasn't just that pagan Greeks were coming and subverting the Jewish Israelite people. There were Israelite priests who were like, yeah, let's go with the Greeks. Hey, Israelites, we're changing the thing. And it was, you know, Mattathias and Judas Maccabeus who said, no, walked up and killed a guy and said, no, you're not going to violate the covenant of our fathers. And he's like, who's with me? Let's go in the wilderness and form an army. We're taking back the temple. We're taking back Jerusalem. Right. That's the people of God. That's the faithful.
Right. The faithful have, if you have good instincts, then you just, you react.
How do you get good instincts? You become virtuous. It's habituated. Right. How do I act in this situation? None of us really know. This is the beauty of virtue ethics. It's not like we have an answer for every single situation. It is practice the virtue every single day. Justice, fortitude, temperance, prudence, faith, hope, charity, all the sub virtues every single day. And when unusual, difficult situations present themselves to you, you will be habituated to choose the right pathway. None of us can prepare for every single contingency. All we can do is wear the grooves in our soul of virtue. Of the seven virtues, become virtuous over time. And then when that moment happens, when it's Mattathias in First Maccabees or whomever, or Phineas in the Old Testament, when that thing happens, you have prepared yourself for that moment. Just like in boxing, you can't prepare for every combination that's out there.
Right. What do I do if he throws a left hook, then a jab? Then it's like, dude, you have to. This is what's called
spar.
You need fluidity of movements.
Right.
Americans in general, not just Catholic Americans, need to reacclimate themselves to reacting in a fair way, what we would call righteous anger. St. Robert Bellarmine wrote at great length about this. Reacting in a prudent way, this is prudence, what you're saying about you can't train for every possible situation. This is the difference between the intellectual virtue of prudence. It's how to apply the law to the facts. And all the other virtues are the moral virtues. It's how do you know which moral virtue to draw from and when? Don't be courageous when you should be charming. Don't be charming when you should be courageous. But Americans need to reacclimate themselves to this. We are much better when we are just colonies, right? Mm-hmm. When the Shays Rebellion happened in 1786, Jefferson was like, in Boston, that's good. That's really good. Let the people revolt, he said. This is one little skirmish, the Shays Rebellion, in 11 years since the Declaration of Independence. I guess it was 1787, because he said that's one in 11 years. A one in 11 years over 13 colonies, that's about one little rebellion every 150 years per state. He did the math. And he's like, that's not sufficient. The people of Republican self-rule have to react organically and vigilantly when something unjust happens. That's the only way Republican rule propagates itself. So little skirmishes, little rebellions, people, I don't know what to do. Do I shake my right fist or my left? You know, do I protest? I don't know. You have to care enough to be like pissed when something really bad happens at mass or in your city or in your state. Right. You have to care. The spiritual vice is called echadia, when you don't care. And that's main thing. Sloth.
Yeah.
That's what I would say what we're doing in this little podcast is we're saying, pull yourself, nation of Israel, out of the sloth, out of the echadia. That we're not saying we have all of the answers. It's just read a few of the right books, not all of them, and try to muscle up, man up out of this waking death where you just don't care. It's apathy, everything. This is what the infiltrators of the church and of American and first world politics have done. They've conduced a pleasure. Aristotle also says the apolaustic life, the pleasure seeking life, he says about 90% of men fall into it. it makes for docile subjects that become slaves,
right?
Because you're enslaved to the sex, you're enslaved to the comforts, you're enslaved to all your appetites. Your intellect is given to you. You're not a bull, right?
Right.
You're a man. Your intellect has been given to you to master your will. When the will follows the intellect, Aristotle defines this as vice. When the, you know, what figures out you're fat first on December 31st because of the holidays? Your intellect. And your intellect says, okay, well, tomorrow we're going for a daily run. We're starting this new regime. At first, your will revolts. Your will will hate it on the first run, the second run. What happens if you keep it up every day for 3 months? By March, your will likes it.
Yep.
You get a runner's high. So your intellect has to fashion via habit your will. That's what we're really trying to do here. And if you don't do it, then you end up acting like a very trainable, docile animal, like a donkey. What do the boys become on Pleasure Island in Pinocchio? Yeah. They become a bunch of donkeys, beasts of burden. Aristotle says that's the pleasure-seeking life.
That's right.
That Americans have fallen into, the apolaustic life. And they're easily able to be led around by the nose. Don't be leadable by the nose by either a corrupt bishop or a corrupt politician. Just react.
Yeah.
Be mad at what you should be mad at.
You know, I like the Pinocchio analogy. Like, Pinocchio starts becoming an ass, a donkey, because he's given into Pleasure Island. They're smoking cigars, right? All those boys. Right. What transforms Pinocchio back, actually not just to being back to a puppet, but to being a human boy? The search for the father.
That's right. That's right.
He wants to find his father.
That's interesting.
As men, women too, but as men especially, we have to find the father. That will not just make us a puppet in the cubicle, not be an ass who's, you know, addicted to pornography and pleasure and sitting on the couch and watching Netflix or whatever. We have to have a passion to finding the father, even if it means going down to the belly of the whale. You know, like, that's a sign of death.
That's
sacrificial. I mean, there's a lot of depth there. But you know, him going to find his father is what ultimately makes him a human. It transforms him. That's the redemption, not seeking the pleasure.
Right.
So, and communism, socialism is the seeking of the pleasure. It wraps it up in some sort of, you know, civic egalitarianism, as you said in the first part of this episode. But ultimately, it's just making everybody have equal pleasure outcomes.
Right. Which makes us
all donkeys.
Right. When we went through the anti-decalogue in our second secret video, right? The anti-decalogue was built around enslaving members of the Politburo and members and citizens of the state to sex.
Yeah.
This is how you make for docile donkey citizens that will just sit idly by and watch as the state aggrandizes itself. And frankly, it's the format that has been followed in American politics to socialize, to socialismize.
Which is why abortion is so important.
Right.
Because if you're sleeping around with as many people as you can, babies happen. Babies are a lot of work. Babies require family investment, 18 years.
Right.
And that's not fun. So in order to have the free sex, the slavery to sex, you have to destroy the natural outcome, which is conception.
Right.
Hence, the party that represents Marxism, the Democratic Party, also defends abortion. The two go together.
To the death. That's what all that Kavanaugh stuff was about.
Exactly. The Kavanaugh debate was on abortion.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though he's probably, I don't think he's the guy. He said when it comes to stare decisis, he'll let past decisions stand, which is very disappointing. I hope not. Even the minor chance that Kavanaugh would be truly brave, which I don't think he would be if it came to overturning Roe. West Virginia just amended its own constitution to provide what we call a test case. Hmm. They could push this up through the courts. This could be a chance to overturn Roe, what West Virginia did two nights ago on election night on Tuesday. Hopefully he'll do it. But the agitators, the Soros plants, and all of these people clawing at the doors of the Supreme Court, they were all paranoid because of the small possibility of a Roe overturn. They are like wretched, raving, lunatical harpies. Yeah. If you take away the abortion, it's a hell of a thing.
Yep.
Yeah. So we got to get active. We really do.
Ave Maria. All right. Well, great. Just housekeeping issues. Listen to these are getting long, but you can listen to them at 1.5 speed on iTunes, on YouTube. Get through them faster if you want to do that. Also, please like and subscribe. Why do we say that? If you like it, it tells YouTube this is a good video and it shows it to other people so they'll see it. And if you subscribe and hit the little bell button, you'll find out when Timothy and I are putting out more videos so you won't miss them. We've also been doing the premieres. Those have been coming out Monday, Wednesday, Friday at noon Central. So you can look for those. I think we'll keep that schedule. And also check out Timothy's book, Catholic Republic. I'll put it up on the screen there. You can get the link into his books and to my books in the show notes. Anything else you want to add besides be virtuous and pray the rosary?
That's all we need. Those thanks.
Awesome.
Yeah, no.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks everybody for watching. God bless. And we'll see you in episodes to come. Bye.